Good morning. My name is Jeff Walls, and I'm a senior economics and international relations major. It is my privilege this morning to introduce today's convocation speaker, Professor Thomas Schelling. Dr. Schelling's achievements span over 7 decades. He worked with the Marshall Plan in Europe and the White House in Washington during the late 1940s and early 1950s. He subsequently served on the economics faculty of Yale and Harvard universities, and later became the Lucius N. Littauer Professor of Political Economy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Currently, Professor Schelling is Distinguished Professor at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy. Dr. Schelling's most renowned book is The Strategy of Conflict, in which he uses the tools and orthodoxies of economics to explain strategic behavior and bargaining between actors. The book is considered one of the 100 books that have been most influential on the West since the end of the Second World War. In his analysis in The Strategy of Conflict, Professor Schelling introduced the concept of a focal point, or Schelling point, as it's now commonly known. This is a point or solution which actors will tend to use in the absence of communication because it is perceived as privileged or special and is therefore useful in strategic decision-making. In addition to using economics to explain strategic behavior in wartime and between nations, Dr. Schelling has also written on subjects such as racial segregation, health policy, and of course, climate change. Professor Schelling's wide range of scholarly interests helped to explain his election to the National Academy of Sciences, the Institute of Medicine, and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. In short, Dr. Schelling uses strategic behavior and game theory to explain big ideas and to understand the intricacies of global problems. Since the advent of the 21st century, Professor Schelling's accomplishments have only continued. In 2004, Dr. Schelling participated in the Copenhagen Consensus, a conference where 8 leading economists convened to reprioritize international aid spending. The economists rated specific proposals based on, if you'll forgive my colloquialism, bang for the buck, or the ability of money spent to meaningfully advance welfare. Intriguingly for today's talk, the economists found the concrete proposals on the table to deal with climate change wanting and rated them poorly. Last, but certainly not least, in 2005, Professor Schelling was awarded the Nobel Prize for Economics for, quote, having advanced our understanding of conflict and cooperation through game theory analysis. Please join me in welcoming Thomas Schelling to Carleton College.
It's lovely to be here. I'm glad to see such an enthusiastic audience. I'm going to talk about greenhouse warming and climate change. I live on the East Coast in the Washington, D.C. area, where everybody is talking constantly about climate change and greenhouse gases. I don't know whether up here in the northern part of the Midwest people take it as seriously. I know you don't worry about rising sea level, but one of the first questions is this subject real? Is the greenhouse phenomenon real and well established? Or is it, as one of the most important people in Washington likes to say, just a theory? Well, the fact that bacteria cause disease is still a theory. It happens to be pretty well established. The fact that two bodies gravitation attraction toward each other is proportionate to the inverse square of the distance between them is still just a theory, but it's, ever since Isaac Newton, it's been pretty well established. The greenhouse phenomenon has been thoroughly understood for at least 100 years. It's been known that Mars is so lacking in greenhouse gases that its surface is too cold to allow water to exist as a liquid. Venus is so covered with greenhouse gases that its surface is too hot for water to exist as a liquid. The Earth, almost miraculously, has just the nicest quantity of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere so that water can exist as a liquid. And without liquid water, there can't be any life. That's been known for 100 years. It's also been known for 100 years that if you shine infrared radiation through a glass chamber full of carbon dioxide, less comes out the other side than went in, and the difference is proportionate to the increase in the temperature of the gas inside the chamber. This is pretty good confirmation of the theory that greenhouse gases, by impeding the outward radiation of heat, that the theory is substantially well established. The question is, the increase in atmospheric temperature around the world just the result of this greenhouse phenomenon? And the answer is, we don't know yet. There are a lot of natural fluctuations in the intensity of sunlight and in other phenomena that may cause some kind of global warming. But I don't think there's any doubt among the scientists who pay attention to this that greenhouse warming is a real phenomenon, and it's part of the warming of the atmosphere that we've experienced. Warming is not quite the description of what's going to happen. The rise in atmospheric temperature will drive climate changes. But I use climate changes in the plural. Climates will change all over the world and change in different ways. Most places will get warmer, but not all. Some may get cooler. Some places precipitation may increase, and some places precipitation may decrease. It's very hard for the meteorologist to estimate what's going to happen in the mountains, and I'm not sure that it matters in Minnesota, but there are large parts of the world that depend very much on snowfall in the wintertime, and if in the Himalayas or the Rocky Mountains or the Sierra Mountains or the Andes, instead of snow they get rain, it won't be available for irrigation during the growing season. If they still get snow but it melts too soon, it won't be available for irrigation in the growing season. So you may hear a lot about the diminution of the volume of glaciers around the world. It's been noticed that in the Andes, in the Alps, in the Himalayas, glaciers are retreating. And people talk about this as a loss of water. They don't have that quite right, because glaciers are not available water. They're frozen water. And if the glaciers don't melt, they don't provide any water. The problem is not glaciers melting. The melting of the glaciers is a symptom of what's happening. The real problem is that if instead of snow they get rain, it's not going to be much help for the farmers. Now, this is a new subject. I don't know when you first heard about it. I first heard about it in 1980 when I got a phone call from the executive director of the National Academy of Sciences saying, would I chair a committee on the carbon dioxide problem? I said, I don't know anything about it. He said, neither does anybody else. And that everything that was known I could learn in the 4 weeks before the committee would meet. Well, we met and we did what we were supposed to do, and then there was a much larger committee of which I was naturally a member. Committee containing atmospheric chemists, atmospheric physicists, meteorologists, agronomists, oceanographers, glaciologists, all of the dozen or 15 disciplines that needed to come together to talk about climate change. There was only one member of that committee who'd had any interest in or association with the issue of greenhouse warming and climate change. And that's because until about 1980, this was not a recognized subject, and the people who were needed to help evaluate it didn't realize that they were participants or potential participants in a study of greenhouse warming. In fact, the current president of the National Academy of Sciences, Ralph Cicerone, was a member of that committee. He was an atmospheric chemist. He was very much involved in discovering the hole in the ozone layer over Antarctica, but he didn't know until this committee was formed that he had anything to do with global warming. Well, it turned out he actually did. And the same was true of a dozen or 15 members of that committee who discovered for the first time that they had something to contribute to this subject. That's why I say it's a new subject. It was potentially there, but it was not recognized as a subject that required the collaboration of a dozen or 15 or maybe in the end 20 different disciplines, all of which had something to contribute, none of which was sufficient by itself to say much about global warming. Now, the fact that the theory has been very well established doesn't mean there are not uncertainties. The first study of this at the end of the 1970s by the National Academy of Sciences made an estimate. They asked, suppose the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere were to double. What would be the change in global surface atmospheric temperature? And they said probably about 3 degrees Celsius, but anyway from 1.5 to 4.5 degrees Celsius. Now 1.5 to 4.5 is a huge range of uncertainty. It's as if my doctor said, Schelling, if you don't stop eating, you're going to put on too much weight. And if I said, how much weight are we talking about? And he said, oh, anywhere from 40 to 120 pounds, I would say, that's a little bit uncertain from my point of view. What I want to mention is that that estimate has hardly changed in what is now going on 30 years. Why hasn't the estimate been changed? Since about 1985, the amount of money spent on climate research is probably somewhere between 100 times and 1,000 times all the money spent on such research before. And the number of people who devote a substantial part of their time to studying the subject, the number of all of those scientists I mentioned, including economists, is somewhere around 100 times as many people who had even ever heard of the subject before 1980. Why hasn't all of this attention and research led to a reduction in the uncertainty? I think there's a good reason for it, and that is that there are certain scientific fields, of which genetics is one and brain science is another, that are vastly more complicated than people thought when they began to get interested. When I first got involved with this subject, the oceans were thought of as merely a huge cooling reservoir that would slow down, would delay the appearance of warmer atmosphere. See, about 4/5 of the Earth is covered with water, and water has a very high specific heat compared with the atmosphere. And therefore, although it's the atmosphere that would get warm through the greenhouse effect, it can't get much warmer until it warms the surface of the oceans. And it takes a lot of heat to warm the surface of the oceans. And therefore, it was expected, back in those days, that the cooling effect of the ocean would slow down the warming by anywhere from a decade to half a century. Oceans weren't thought of as anything but a cooling reservoir. Now the oceans are recognized to be very active players in the conveyance of heat around the world. And we have the El Nino phenomenon in the Pacific, and we have the Humboldt Current in Latin America, the Gulf Stream in the North Atlantic, the Japanese Current off the coast of California and Canada. And all of these transport heat very complicated ways around the world. As a result, the oceans are now recognized as a complex part of the phenomenon. Another one is clouds. Clouds were ignored 25 years ago. It wasn't known whether clouds had any effect, and nobody knew how to study clouds. Well, now clouds are recognized as being either reflectors of incoming sunlight or absorbers of outgoing radiation, depending on the sizes of the droplets and the altitude of the clouds. One other point to make, which is incidental, but I think worth appreciating. A lot of people talk about carbon dioxide as a pollutant. In fact, all three of the people who are running for the presidency have referred to carbon dioxide as a pollutant. That underestimates the virtue of carbon dioxide. I mentioned that without greenhouse gases, we might be as cold as Mars. But remember this, all living green things, the grass, the trees, the bushes, the flowers, the fruit, all consume carbon dioxide. That's their diet. Without carbon dioxide, there couldn't be any grass, couldn't be any wheat, corn, trees. It's vital, and since animals either eat vegetation or eat each other, they all depend on vegetation. So carbon dioxide is not only necessary for the climate we enjoy, but it's also the crucial ingredient of all living things. So please don't refer to it as a pollutant. Nobody ever mentions that oxygen is a pollutant, but think what would happen if the concentration of oxygen in the atmosphere were to double. This building would probably burn down. Every forest fire would rage uncontrolled. Lightning striking a cornfield would start a bushfire. Any kind of a fire in an urban area would become a conflagration, just because with that much oxygen, everything burns. With enough oxygen, you can make iron burn. I mention that just to, so that you will remember always to appreciate carbon dioxide. The only problem is too much, just as too much food is not good for people. The biggest uncertainty, I think, about the impact of climate change is what's the world going to be like in 50, 75, or 100 years when climate change is likely to become serious. If you think back 50 or 75 years, we didn't have electronics, we didn't have plastics, we had celluloid. We had very few vaccines, smallpox was about the only one. We had neither nuclear energy nor nuclear medicine, which has revolutionized medical diagnostics and treatment. There weren't any antibiotics. If you'd asked somebody in the 1920s what would likely be the problems brought about by climate change over the next 50 to 100 years, I think a likely answer would have been mud. In those days, automobile tires were about 2.5 inches in diameter. They were pumped up to 60 pounds per square inch pressure. They were as hard as wood. And mud made automobile travel almost impossible. Very few roads were paved in those days. I had several uncles who were farmers who, in the summertime, made a pretty good amount of money by hitching up a team of horses to an automobile to drag it out of a mud hole. Maybe the same thing about snow, although we don't think of snow as being a pollutant. If I were to ask, let's say I came to Minnesota and found an 85 or 90-year-old farmer who'd been born on a farm, stayed on the farm, worked the farm, and finally retired to let his children work the farm, and I asked him, what are the differences in farming between when you were a boy or when you were a young man, and when you retired from farming? Was climate change a significant part of it? If we'd had in the last 80 years the kind of climate change that is anticipated for the next 80 or 90 years, would he be able to recognize the climate change? I think he would be very aware of the disappearance of the horse. I think he'd be very aware of new strains of crops, like hybrid corn or the introduction of soybeans. I think he'd be impressed with harvesting machinery that didn't exist when he was a boy. It'd be hard for him to detect changes in temperature because now he has parkas and boots and gloves and things made of materials that didn't exist when he was a boy. He had more protection against rain and snow. He had snow tires in the winter and mud tires in the summer. If there was still any mud around that he had to drive through, I think he would have a hard time detecting the change in climate through personal impression. And I think it's going to be the same thing in trying to imagine how are people going to be earning a living, taking their recreation, transporting themselves, even what will they be eating 50, 75, or 100 years from now. It's easy to imagine climate change superimposed on the society of today, but to imagine how it's going to be superimposed on the society of the future is difficult. It may not be as difficult for us as it would be for the Chinese or the Indians, who are developing so rapidly that they're probably going to change as much in the next 50 or 75 years as in America things have changed in the last 50 or 75 years. And I think that's one of the great uncertainties in understanding what's going to be the impact of climate change. Now, I think to a first approximation, we can say the impact on developed countries like the United States, Western Europe, Canada, Japan, and a few other countries, the impact of climate change, Al Gore to the contrary notwithstanding, is probably not going to be great. I'll make an exception to that, a possible catastrophe that we might want to consider. But except for a possible catastrophe, most of what we do in Montana or Massachusetts or Texas or even Alaska, most of what we do is pretty immune to climate. We can have a gathering like this where I can speak to you in your shirt sleeves in any state of the union. We can manufacture in any state of the union. We don't manufacture a lot in Alaska, but that's because of the distance required for transport. In any state, we can do radio and television broadcasting. We can do banking and finance and insurance. We can do medical care. We do open heart surgery in every state of the union. About the only activities substantially affected by climate are agriculture, which you may be very conscious of in Minnesota, but the truth is agriculture, together with fisheries and forestry, are barely 3% of U.S. economic activity. They contribute barely 3% to the gross domestic product of this country. Outdoor recreation will probably benefit from most of the climate change. But even professional sports, baseball and football, have substantially gone indoors in bad weather and may do more so over the next 50 years or so. They can hold the PGA, the Professional Golf Association, can hold golf tournaments in Florida, California, Massachusetts, anywhere. If it rains, they can postpone it for a day. Where then will the impact really be? And I think the answer is in the countries that we now call developing. India, China, Indonesia, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Peru, Bolivia, Brazil. In many of these countries, agriculture is as much as one-third of their entire economic activity. And agriculture is what is mainly vulnerable to climate change. The climate change may not be harmful to agriculture everywhere, but you know, even beneficial climate change may be hard for developing countries to adapt to, because if the weather becomes conducive to greater productivity, the greater productivity can only come about if they change their agricultural practices to take advantage of the new climate. And in many developing countries, they have nothing like our Agricultural Extension Service, which makes the results of scientific research available to farmers. If the climate of Minnesota begins to look more like the climate of Arkansas, The Agricultural Extension Service has plenty of evidence from Arkansas on what kind of crops will thrive best in that climate. But in Pakistan, it isn't clear that they have any such scientific assistance available to farmers, even to adapt to what might be beneficial climate change. So I would say that in terms of the impact on economic productivity, developed countries are relatively safe from the effect of climate change, but the major developing countries and the minor developing countries are currently very vulnerable. But now I must pay attention to what I told you just 5 minutes ago, namely, the countries we call developing countries today are mostly, not all of them, especially not in sub-Saharan Africa, but India, China, Peru, Brazil, are developing quite rapidly. And the hope will be that by the time climate change becomes serious, they will have developed to where they are substantially less vulnerable to climate than they are now. And that leads to a policy prescription, which is don't demand of the developing countries that in the interest of slowing down climate change, they retard their own development. Their best defense against climate change will be their own economic development. And that's not true only of their productivity. Right now, there is a lot of concern that climate change will have a severe impact on health. I don't think it'll have an impact on health in our country. But there are 1 or 2 million deaths per year due to malaria. There are actually 1 million children's deaths in the world due to measles. There are a variety of vector-borne tropical diseases spread by fleas, flies, gnats, mosquitoes, snails, and other such things that are rather horrific to the children and the adults that contract these diseases. How can measles kill 1 million children? When I was a boy, everybody got measles. We didn't have vaccine. If anybody in the United States died of measles, it would have had to be some very poor person in a very rural area where there wasn't even a doctor to report it. Because even in those days, poor American children were not as weak and badly nourished as children in sub-Saharan Africa or Bangladesh or Bolivia. Most of the kids who die of measles die because they are so undernourished or so suffering from some chronic disease that they haven't the strength to survive a disease like measles. Good example, Singapore is separated from Malaysia by 1 kilometer of seawater. There's no malaria in Singapore. Malaria is a scourge in Malaysia. Well, Singapore has the advantage of being by now, a very high-income country, compact and dense, so that they can afford to make sure that mosquitoes don't breed. But if a Singaporean spends a weekend in Malaysia and gets bit by a mosquito and comes home with malaria, he or she gets excellent medical care, may require a few days of hospitalization, may be a little bit weak for 6 months, but it's not a life-threatening disease if you're healthy to begin with. This suggests also that the development in these areas may be their best defense against the adverse health impact of climate change. For reasons that I don't think are very well known, most of the insects that spread these diseases become more active the warmer it is. And that means if, in general, the tropical areas expand because of warming, the areas in which these diseases are now rampant may enlarge. Also, for reasons that I don't think are well known, the pathogens, the microbes that cause these diseases become more virulent in hot weather. That strongly suggests that the health effects of climate change, on balance, may be adverse. But as I mentioned, better nutrition will help. Development will help, because the more these countries develop, the better their ability to help extinguish the places where mosquitoes breed. River blindness, which is caused by snails, transmitted by snails, is being eliminated in Africa. Guinea worm, a horrible disease, is gradually being eliminated in Africa. It would be a shame and a disgrace if in the next 30, 40, or 50 years we haven't eliminated malaria and most of those other diseases. All it takes is money and some good sense about how to distribute what is needed. Nutrition should improve. 1 million people a year go blind for lack of vitamin A. There are a lot of inexpensive nutrients that are lacking in the diets of the very poor. And if we can find a delivery system to get them those nutrients, the amount of money involved in getting nutrients to them is not great. Eventually, with development, may become access to fresh drinking water. And we're all aware right now that in Burma, 100,000 people may die for a lack of fresh drinking water. And with development may come better sewage disposal, which is closely associated with better drinking water. So I have to hope that with development, these countries can better afford the nutrition they need, the healthcare infrastructure they need, the prenatal care and things of that sort. And I mention this because if, as I believe, the greatest dangers of climate change are going to be in the developing world, it's important to recognize that their own development is crucial to their being able to adapt to climate change. The question arises, what is being done or what can be done to slow down climate change? I don't know how you people feel about biofuels. I read something this morning that suggested that Minnesota is proud to be consuming so much in the form of biofuels. I think in the long run, biofuels have no great future. I think in the long run, any area in which food can be grown will compete with any area, with other such areas. The food will compete with ethanol as a fuel. You've been reading in the newspaper for a couple of weeks that there is a food price crisis around the world, so great that a lot of food-producing nations are prohibiting exports. And in countries, several countries, there are food riots because of the high price of food. I think this is not a momentary crisis. I think this is going to be a phenomenon of the future. And I'll explain why. If you go into somebody's dining room in Minnesota in the evening, almost every family eats meat. In all of the well-to-do countries, except for a few vegetarians who avoid meat on ideological grounds, except for a few vegetarians, nearly every family eats meat. In a lot of the developing world, there are children who have never seen meat on the table. They may have seen meat on the hoof, but the meat gets on the hoof gets sold to people who can afford meat. As incomes rise, it is being observed that diets shift in the direction of meat. This has been very noticeable in China. In fact, the first time I was in China 25 years ago, health people were beginning to worry about Chinese citizens eating too much fat, because they were already, with a degree of development, able to afford meat. Now, it takes about 8 calories of grain to produce 1 calorie of beef. It takes about 6 calories of grain to produce 1 calorie of pork. It takes about 4 calories of grain to make 1 calorie of chickens, duck, geese, or other fowl. I don't know how many of you in Minnesota, being a farming state, about that, but this means that as the demand for meat grows, simply as a result of rising incomes, and keep in mind that the Chinese per capita income is rising at about 6% per year, if not more, I think this shift toward the meat diet as countries become more well-to-do is going to mean that we can't afford to use acreage good for food grains for ethanol as a biofuel. So I would say that over a short period of time, with subsidies by the U.S. government, biofuels may look good, but eventually I think they cannot compete with food. Now, how are nations going to cope with the need to reduce carbon emissions? I think the first thing to notice is that we don't really have the technology to do a lot about carbon emissions. We have the technology to make smaller automobiles. That's easy. We have the technology to produce buildings that require less electricity for either heat or air conditioning. We have a lot of technology by which to offset the growing use of energy. But in order to reduce reliance on the fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas, over the coming century, we're going to need new ways to convert sunlight directly into electricity, new ways to store electricity in economical batteries. We're going to need a lot of new technology, and we're not doing much to develop it. Some of you may be old enough to remember what we called the energy crisis of the 1970s, back at the time that OPEC got started as an oil cartel. Would you believe that now that 30 years have passed since the oil crisis of the 1970s, U.S. government investment in new technology, new energy technology, is about half what it was then? Our gross domestic product is up by a quarter. Our investment in energy technology is down by a half. And the same is true of Western Europe. Japan, I think, is the only major country that has embarked on a research and development program in the belief that if it can develop the energy technologies of the next half century, it can make money by exporting the technology or the technology embodied in equipment that will be needed around the world. I mention this because I think it's crucially important to develop the technology we need. During World War II, we developed nuclear weapons, nuclear power, and eventually nuclear medicine. It only took about 4 years to develop something that had never existed before. In the 1960s, we developed the capacity to send people to the moon where they could survive and walk around and return. There doesn't seem to be an impetus in the U.S. government now to do anything like that with respect to the need for new energy technology. We can hope that one of those 3 candidates, of whom one is bound to become president, we can hope that they take a stronger interest in this subject, particularly in connection with research and development for the technologies that are bound to be needed. What else can be done? Well, so far, I would say international cooperation, perhaps as evidenced in the Kyoto Protocol of 1997, or the Bali Conference of some months ago, or even a conference of Latin American governments and West European governments taking place in Lima next week. I don't think these efforts have yet demonstrated much by way of accomplishment. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that. But first, let me say, I think there are probably three nations in the Kyoto Treaty who may achieve the targets with which they were identified back in 1997. Britain, Germany, and Russia. All of the Kyoto targets were based on 1990, and in 1990, or right around then, three very important things happened with respect to energy. The United Kingdom had access to new sources of oil and gas in the North Sea, and partly under the direction of the Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, they converted very substantially from coal to natural gas for the production of electricity, sufficiently that they may come close to their Kyoto target. Just coincidence, 1990 was the base year for Kyoto. 1990 was approximately the year that the UK began to have ample supplies of gas from the North Sea. Germany, again by coincidence, 1990 was approximately the year when East Germany was incorporated into the Federal Republic of Germany. And East Germany had an exceedingly obsolete coal-based electric power industry, which they have now had almost two decades to modernize. And they modernize for the sake of efficiency, but in the process, they substantially reduced their reliance on coal as a source of electric power. Russia, again, 1990 was approximately the year that the Soviet Union disbanded. Russia came into existence as a separate nation and fell into a very severe depression from which it has not recovered. And if you go through a severe depression, among other things, you consume less energy because the people who normally would be paying for more heating fuel, more cooking fuel, more electricity, are able to afford less of it. So three countries may come close to meeting their Kyoto targets. It isn't likely that anybody else will in those three countries, only because of things that were independent of whatever they might have done deliberately by way of policy to reduce their carbon emissions. I think there were two things wrong with Kyoto. One was that there was a pretense that the quotas developed could be enforced. The other was that the targets all embodied not what nations would actually do, but what the results would be 15 years later. I don't think any nation at the time had any good idea of what they would have to do to reach the Kyoto targets. I have a hunch that if Al Gore had become president in the year 2000, he was committed, because he had participated in Kyoto, he would have been committed to submit the Kyoto Treaty for Senate ratification. And I think any senator would have said, President Gore, if we ratify this treaty, then what do we have to do? Are you going to ask for new taxes? Are you going to ask for subsidies? Are you going to ask for regulations on motor vehicles, regulations on building construction, subsidies for wind turbines? What do we have to do in order to reach the targets embodied in the Kyoto Treaty? And I think poor Al Gore would have had to say, I just don't know. Give me a year and I'll tell you. And if they said, well, what have you been doing for the 3 years since Kyoto? I guess he'd have to say, I've been running for president. And then I think they would say, well, when you come back and tell us exactly what we will have to do if we ratify this treaty, then we will consider ratifying the treaty. I don't think things were any better in any other country, except that they didn't have to submit the treaty to a skeptical Senate for ratification, so they ratified it. And as I mentioned, only three by happenstance may actually meet their targets. I think there is probably no way that any such set of quotas could be enforced. I'll give you an example. The European Union, which is about as formal an established regime as anybody could imagine for a climate regime, the European Union has as one of its most important principles, any member of the Union that runs a government deficit greater than 3% of GDP for 3 years in a row will be subject to extreme sanctions. 4 years ago, both France and Germany were about to complete the third year in a row in which they didn't meet that requirement. Nobody expected anything to be done. Nothing was done. Even as tightly knitted an organization as the European Union is supposed to be, had no means of enforcing one of its strictest financial rules on the member countries, especially two big member countries. If we had quotas, either for 30 or 35 OECD countries or for 180 countries around the world, I don't see any possibility of enforcing penalties on the United States if we didn't meet a target or a quota. Nobody's going to invade us. Nobody's going to blockade us. Nobody's going to cut diplomatic relations. Nobody's going to impose trade restrictions on American goods. I don't think anybody's going to impose severe penalties on a country like Bolivia or Guatemala if they don't meet some kind of a target. A few years ago, 2,000 American economists took out a page in the New York Times saying that only a strict allocation of quotas among all the countries of the world with strong incentives based on penalties. That's the only way we could cope with the greenhouse problem. I didn't sign the statement. I agreed with the principle that about the only kind of system that we know of that might work would have to involve enforceable quotas, where the enforcement was by some kind of strong incentives. But I didn't see anything in the history of the world in which that kind of enforcement mechanism had ever existed on such a scale. Some people said the World Trade Organization, the WTO, was a massively important international treaty and organization that had effective enforcement mechanisms. But the World Trade Organization is really a complex of purely bilateral relations between pairs of countries. And any violation of the WTO immediately identifies a plaintiff, a claimant for relief. If the United States imposes an improper tariff on French cheese, France can immediately go to a judicial system located in Switzerland and get permission to take retaliatory action against the United States and stop importing whatever it may be. I won't say American wines, but some American product. So the WTO really is a system of bilateral relations, and any violation of the WTO is a violation against a particular country that has a motive and a means of retaliating. So that's not a model. When I ask myself, is there any model of international cooperation on the scale that would be required to cope with the greenhouse problem, I find only one example. It's not a perfectly applicable model, but it can stimulate ideas. That's the North Atlantic Treaty. You know, the North Atlantic Treaty is only about 2 printed pages. It doesn't assign anything to any country. It simply says each participant hereby agrees to treat any attack on any other member of the North Atlantic Treaty as an attack on itself. That's the only obligation in the treaty. Then beginning in about 1951, they began to negotiate, all the members, what commitments they would accept in terms of raising troops, training troops, procuring equipment and ammunition, in some cases stationing troops in Germany, giving up real estate for maneuvers, giving up real estate for the housing of, say, Americans. And the interesting thing is that without any notion of sanctions, any notion of penalties for failing to meet those commitments, the commitments on the whole were met. All the countries of the North Atlantic Treaty recruited large numbers of young men and kept them in service for long periods of time, stationing many of them in Germany. And as a result, we ended up with a NATO establishment that was almost beyond what anybody could have envisaged back in 1949 when the treaty was under discussion. Now, NATO had an advantage. It was a successor to the Marshall Plan, and under the Marshall Plan, after the first year, the United States insisted that the Marshall Plan countries divide up the aid among themselves. And they went through a huge process over a period of 6 months developing uniform data from all the countries, and then they spent about 2 months in Paris arguing, each trying to defend what it proposed it needed by way of American aid, everybody knowing that more for France meant less for Greece, and more for Greece meant less for France, and so forth. And eventually, they couldn't quite reach agreement on division of aid, but they were close enough that two people went off to Fontainebleau for the weekend and came back with a proposal which was unanimously accepted. Then in 1951, when the original European Recovery Program, which was the official name of the Marshall Plan, when it had been converted to a mutual security program, the same thing was done with the U.S. aid in relation to the NATO military commitments. So the United States was there with a significant amount of money to be contributed so that it could require these countries to agree on what they would do. They didn't quite agree, but this time three people went off somewhere for the weekend and came back with a proposal that was unanimously accepted. Well, the US aid money disappeared within a couple of years, but those commitments remained. And the only enforcement of those commitments was what I would call self-respect on the part of the governments that had accepted those commitments. Well, make what you can of it. I tend to think that if the developed countries could get together in something like the spirit of NATO, not recognizing a military enemy, but recognizing a serious joint problem, maybe something like that NATO procedure of negotiating very hard, every nation defending what it proposed to do or not to do, might work. The other thing to notice about NATO, none of these commitments were to results. They were commitments to what nations would do. Nobody said, I will contribute to a slowing down of a Soviet invasion by 3 days, or I will reduce the likelihood of a Soviet invasion by 3%. They said, this is what we will do. And that meant that any government knew whether it was meeting its commitments, and the neighboring governments knew whether they were meeting their commitments. And I think if we are to have some kind of international regime in which nations make commitments, they should be to the steps that will be taken rather than the results 15 or 20 years down. I'm going to run out of time, so let me quickly raise just a few other issues. Is there any possibility of a catastrophe due to climate change? I think if you saw Al Gore's movie, you may have come across with the feeling that Minnesota will be covered with another ice age or something like that will happen. The main catastrophe that I think has been identified has to do with something called the West Antarctic Ice Sheet. When floating ice melts, it does nothing to sea level. That's the principle of Archimedes that has been known for 2,000 years. When ice on a continent melts, it does flow into the ocean, but it isn't expected that the Greenland ice is likely to melt, at least not rapidly over the next few centuries. But there is in Antarctica an unusual body of ice. It's called grounded ice. It's sort of like an iceberg resting on the bottom of the ocean, adjacent to to the continental Antarctica. Since it's on the bottom, any more ice added just builds up. And this is a body of ice resting on the bottom that rises 1 or 2 kilometers above sea level. If it moved into the ocean, it would raise sea level. It's penned in by several islands, but there are a lot of studies suggesting that it may be becoming lubricated by warm water underneath it, and it may break up or glaciate into the ocean. This is worth about 18 or 20 feet of sea level. There goes Stockholm. There goes Copenhagen. There goes most of Los Angeles. There goes a number of cities around the world, and there goes the land on which a few tens of millions of Bangladeshis live. They're all below 20 feet above sea level. This would really be a catastrophe. Manhattan would be submerged, but Manhattan could do what the Dutch have done for centuries, build dikes. And I suppose Los Angeles could build a dike. And the Danes could build a dike around Copenhagen, but an awful lot of Denmark would be underwater. Bangladesh would be hard to protect with dikes, partly because it has too much coastline, but also because if you built a dike around Bangladesh, they would all drown in fresh water because they already have freshwater floods. You can't get a river to flow toward the ocean and then go up and over a dike. In fact, half the dikes in the Netherlands are dikes against the Rhine and other rivers that flow through because the rivers cannot be below sea level, but the land they border is below sea level. Amsterdam, for example, is about 14 feet below sea level. The Dutch are comfortable that way, but it isn't clear that the Dutch could dike against a 20-foot sea level rise the way they've done it, because they build most of their dikes out of sand that is scraped up from the North Sea bottom, and the dikes are about as high as you can build with sand. If they want rocks, they have to import them. Otherwise, they have to use cement, which is a more elaborate mode of defense. So that's a possible catastrophe, and it's an interesting coincidence. Concern about global warming and climate change arose just about the same time that we began to have satellite reconnaissance of the Earth, the oceans, the continents, the clouds, that can measure temperatures, can even measure sea level height and things of that sort. Now you can do what you couldn't do when I was on a committee studying this in the 1980s. Now you can put a beacon of some kind on a glacier, and you can measure its motion from satellites accurately to within an inch per month. And as a result, there is much more knowledge about what's going on in the forests and in the glaciers. And as a result, it has turned out that when we, on that committee I was on in the early 1980s, we were concerned enough, we asked a bunch of glaciologists to come together and tell us what was likely to happen on this West Antarctic ice sheet. We were reassured that something could happen, but it would take 300 or 400 or 500 years, and we would have plenty of warning in advance. Now the scientists are not nearly so confident. And so this is one of the things that you want to stay tuned in for, because that's the nearest thing to a catastrophe that we can think of. Finally, there's a subject you're going to hear more about over the next 10 years. It's been around for 20 years. It's slowly coming out of the closet. It's called geoengineering. It relates to putting something in the stratosphere that will screen out some incoming sunlight. See, the problem with global warming is that energy comes in from the sun all the time. Energy goes out mostly at night in the form of infrared radiation. And if they get out of balance, it gets either warmer or colder. With the growth of greenhouse gases, which impede outgoing radiation, the atmosphere has to get warm enough so that the outgoing radiation is increased to where it balances the incoming radiation. Now, It has been known for 100 years that if you get sulfur up in the stratosphere, it cools things remarkably. The last one that did that noticeably was Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines in 1991, put several cubic kilometers of sulfur into the stratosphere, and the globe cooled for a year or two. And it's been known ever since 1815, when a huge volcano erupted in what is now Indonesia, that it was known in New England as the year that summer never came. Lakes in New Hampshire and Vermont were frozen over as late as August and September because of sulfur. So somebody says, no, one more thing. Sulfur particulates, what is properly called pollution, sulfur particulates coming from China, the United States, Germany, and other places, resulting from the burning of coal, are also apparently screening out some of the incoming sunlight. So the question arises, can we put something up there, maybe not sulfur, which is not healthful to people or animals or fish, put something up in the stratosphere that will screen out some of the sunlight to reestablish the balance between the incoming and the outgoing energy? Question, how much sunlight would you have to screen out to offset a doubling of greenhouse gases? And the answer is apparently somewhere between 1.5% and 2%, which doesn't sound awfully challenging. Nobody at the beach would notice it. Nobody would be able to use less sunscreen because of 1.5% or 2% less. I'm told that none of the astronomers on Palomar Mountain could tell the difference when they looked through their telescopes. That sounds easy. If we wanted to do it with sulfur, it doesn't sound too bad, because the sulfur that we put in the air now every year appears to be at least 10 times the amount you would have to put in the stratosphere, because when you put it in the stratosphere, it stays up there for a long time, a year or more. Most of the sulfur pollution we have is down low, and it only stays for a week or two. And therefore, there's a lot of it because we keep pumping more of it into the air. But a small amount compared with that in the stratosphere might do the job, and it wouldn't be any difficult task to get it up in the stratosphere. This idea, when I used to mention it 15 years ago, led everybody, half the people in the audience, to think I was crazy and the other half to think I was dangerous. Now I think the main objection to talking about it is from people who believe if this comes to look like a cheap and easy solution, then people will stop being concerned about mitigating climate change by reducing carbon emissions. They're going to relax and say, oh, well, the scientists will take care of it when it comes about. That seems to be the objection. And I think it's a valid objection. An interesting thing about this is that it will probably, if it's done, be economical enough that any one of a large number of countries might do it alone. And therefore, it might not require a big international negotiation, except among countries that badly want this not to be allowed to happen, either because they think it's too much dependence on scientific geniuses who haven't thought about all the consequences. There may turn out to be religious objections, a whole variety of objections. But look what it would do. Instead of having to change the way 7 or 8 billion people cook their food and warm their houses and transport themselves in the second half of the century, we just shoot something up into the stratosphere and take care of it. It's going to be very tempting. It's not being experimented with yet, and I'm not sure whether you could get international agreement to allow such experiments to go forward. Back in the 1960s, when satellites, especially Soviet and American military satellites, were being put in orbit, there was some question whether It was internationally illegal. It was the equivalent of flying through the airspace of another country. But since both the Soviet Union and the United States wanted these satellites, they decided, let's forget that and go ahead. That kind of an objection could still be raised. We can say, you put something up in the stratosphere over the United States, that's our airspace, that's our business. Well, as I said, you'll be hearing more about this. I have just one final remark to make, because I see that people have classes to attend. Anything that is expensively done to reduce the rate of climate change, as I said, will be the main beneficiaries will be the descendants of people who now live in the developing countries. There is every expectation that they will be much better off than their grandparents. In other words, the Chinese of 2075 are likely to be much better off than the Chinese of 2008. That raises the question, if my great-grandchildren speak to a Chinese 75 years from now and say, you should be happy that my grandparents, my great-grandparents, did so much to preserve the climate and make you better off, I can imagine the Chinese saying, yeah, but what did you do for my grandparents? It's sort of anomalous to be terribly concerned about two or three or four generations in the future when we're not terribly concerned about contemporary people who are, for the most part, much worse off than their descendants are going to be. And I think that raises the question, why would we be willing to help the Indians and the Chinese and all those people of a few generations from now when we do so little to help them now? For example, why don't we do something for the Chinese? I think the answer is probably, it's very hard to dislike people who haven't been born yet. Look at the Chinese. They have a bad civil rights record. They pirate our intellectual treasures. They send rockets over Taiwan. Who wants to do anything for the Chinese? But the unborn Chinese, they're still innocent. Let's take care of them. I would propose that we have an equal interest in the populations of sub-Saharan Africa right now, an equal interest in them, at least an equal interest in their descendants. And I find it sort of anomalous that we talk about doing so much for future generations through slowing down climate change when we do so little for the people who really need the help right now. I think I've used up my time. Thank you very much for listening.